Right there on the dot. Coming up next is your Monday evening news, but first, this from KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Montevilla Jazz Festival on Saturday, August 17th and Sunday, August 18th at Portland Metro Arts in Portland. The Montevilla Jazz Festival features performances by Brian Smith, Dana Reason, Mel Brown and Gordon Lee, and many more. Again, that's the Montevilla Jazz Festival on Saturday, August 17th and Sunday, August 18th at Portland Metro Arts, 9003 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. KBOO will be broadcasting live from the festival on Saturday from 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll screen Power of Community, How Cuba Survived Peak Oil on Thursday, August 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1990, Cuba's oil supply was cut by more than half. This film tells of the hardships and struggles as well as the community and creativity of the Cuban people during this transition away from a highly mechanized agricultural system to one using organic methods of farming and local urban gardens. Again, that's How Cuba Survived Peak Oil, Thursday, August 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Community Radio. Coming up next is your Monday evening news. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts, presenting Steve Earle and Dukes with Lucas Nelson and Promise of the Real. Sunday, August 11th, all ages welcome. Tickets and more information available online at zooconcerts.com. Guess what, news fans? It's so your time.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, two mass shootings in Ohio and Texas during the weekend.
We'll have an interview with Columbia Riverkeeper's Miles Johnson.
And in international news, Facebook suspends over 350 Saudi propaganda accounts.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 5th, 2019. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Ken Jones. At least 31 people were gunned down over the weekend in a deadly duo of shootings in Texas and Ohio. In El Paso, Texas, 22 people were killed and dozens injured after a 21-year-old domestic terrorist opened fire inside a Walmart near the Cielo Vista Mall around 10:30 on Saturday morning. Authorities say the suspect surrendered when approached by officers in Walmart and is now in custody. While investigating the scene, police found a document containing racist and anti-immigrant views left behind by the suspect. The document lists the increasing Hispanic population in Texas as the reason for the attack. The next day, on Sunday, a 24-year-old white male opened fire in downtown Dayton, Ohio, killing 9 and injuring 27 people. The gunman wore a bulletproof vest, mask, and hearing protection, but was killed by police within seconds of the attack. Among the victims was the gunman's sister. The motivation for the shooting remains unclear. Currently, prosecutors are pursuing domestic terrorism charges, a civil rights hate crime investigation, and capital murder charges against the 21-year-old domestic terrorist. A Portland vigil is planned for Tuesday evening, that's tomorrow, at Augustana Lutheran Church to mourn the lives lost in the two mass shootings.
And stories of heroism are starting to emerge from those horrific incidents. On Saturday morning, Army Private First Class Glendon Oakley saved several children after that gunman opened fire inside the Walmart in El Paso. Oakley was made aware of the situation after a child rushed to him claiming there is an active shooter. Oakley, being an active military man, jumped into action and started gathering children to a safe space. Here is Army Private First Class Oakley speaking to news reporters after the shooting.
I was in a sports store named Fanatics. I was buying a jersey, and a little kid runs in there and says it's an active shooter at Walmart. But me and the guy, we didn't pay no mind because, you know, he's just a little kid. So I walk out, and I go to Foot Locker, and all I hear is, ball, ball. So I got my license to carry, and I'm in the military. So all I think is, you know, get my gun and think fast. So they closed, Foot Locker closed the cage, but some people lifted it because I guess they were so scared they wanted to make it out. So I peeled out with them, and I just followed them, and I see a whole bunch of kids just running around without their parents. So I'm just thinking about the kids, so I pick up as many as possible and carry them with me, and another guy does it as well. And I'm sorry, I'm shaking up, I can't think. But I just peeled out. I just hope the kids make it safe, man, because it was a whole bunch of kids just running around without their parents, and I worried about the kids more than myself.
You said you heard the shots, right?
Yeah, he did too.
Again, just tell us how this feels like.
Well, I'm in the military, so I probably feel different from me because, you know, we're trained to, when you hear a gunshot, to pull out your weapon and think fast. So I'm just worried. I wasn't really worried about myself. I was worried about the kids. So I put my stuff out. I just picked up the kids and just carried them with me. Me and the other guy did. We made it through Dillard's. So I wasn't really worried about myself.
What ran through your mind when the first shots rang out? When you heard the first shots, what ran through your mind?
You know, I'm in the military. I couldn't even tell you. It's a feeling that anybody in the military can tell you. It's a feeling that you can't explain. You know what I'm saying? Your heart just, all you think is pull out your weapon and think fast.
I'm curious, what were the kids' reactions when you
just
were
running around crying? They were all just running around crying, just running around. And all I could think about was kids. I think about it as if my child was in this same predicament, what I would want somebody else to do. So I picked them up, and the other guy did as well. But it was so many kids that we couldn't pick them all up, you know what I'm saying? So I couldn't go back and, you know, do what it do, but I tried my best to, me and the other guy tried our best to get as many out as possible, but that's all that was. I can't really do nothing.
On Friday afternoon, three people were victims in a shooting that resulted in one killed and two others injured near 42nd Avenue and Holman Street in Northeast Portland. The murder victim was Deontay Strickland. The other two victims received help, and the police described their injuries as non-threatening. The police arrested 30-year-old Tamina Strickland on a murder charge and two counts of attempted murder. Damian Strickland, Deontay's uncle, said it was Deontay's sister who shot him. She's currently held in the Multnomah County Detention Center without bail. Deontay Strickland attended Portland State University. He played on their basketball team and joined the football team the upcoming season. Portland State Director of Athletics Valerie Cleary shared how he left a great impact on his community. She said, "We're deeply, deeply saddened by the loss of Deontay. He represented everything it means to be a Viking in his hometown of Portland." Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler tweeted out his support as well. Quote, "Our hearts go out to the families impacted by the triple shooting in Northeast Portland. We are grieving with you."
On Friday afternoon, a peaceful protest here in Portland led by Jewish leaders and immigration rights activists resulted in several arrests. After law enforcement officers warned protesters that they could be arrested for blocking federal property, the protesters continued to block the driveway of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office. About 11 of the protesters were arrested, many of them women and college students from Portland State University. The protesters sang chants and songs in a variety of languages. They demanded that elected officials close the detention centers, provide protection for immigrants, and defund ICE. Some demonstrators set up a line of bronze-colored shoes, including a pair that was in a detention center. This represented the children's shoes found outside the German concentration camps, which were bronzed as a memorial of the child's first steps. The demonstration was part of the Never Again Action, which is a mass mobilization of Jews who are organizing to shut down ICE.
Ron Wyden called lawmakers back to Washington, D.C. for an emergency session in response to the mass shootings over the weekend. Wyden's pushing a debate on legislation that requires background checks on all firearms, including those sold on gun shows and the Internet. Other members of the delegation have called for immediate action as well. In February, the House passed its version of the bill, but has gone without a vote for 5 months. After the shootings that left many dead, Wyden believes background checks are urgent. On Sunday afternoon, a crowd gathered at a town hall in Beaverton for a two-hour-long public meeting with Wyden. They questioned him on his plan for ending gun violence, as well as on impeachment proceedings.
Portland environmental groups are suggesting that people pull their clothes out of the dryer this week. Imara Moore has more on this story in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
For Oregonians looking to become greener, environmental groups are suggesting that people pull their clothes out of the dryer this week. The Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club in Solar, Oregon are hosting Hang Dry Your Laundry for Climate Change Week. Joe Wachunas, a Solar, Oregon contractor, says this is one place where Americans can save a lot of energy. It's estimated that each load of laundry uses about 3 kilowatt hours of energy, and each kilowatt hour needs about 1 pound of coal.
So you're talking about 3 pounds of coal every time you run your dryer, and they're estimates anywhere from 4 to 10% of residential houses' electricity use is spent on the dryer.
Wachunas says the beauty of hang drying is that it's easy and folks only need a laundry line or drying rack. He adds for people who are afraid of colors fading in the sun, they can turn their clothes inside out. The eco-friendly Spin Laundry Lounge in Portland is hosting a celebration on Saturday to promote hang drying. Wachunas says his epiphany on hang drying came after spending a year as an exchange student in Italy, where only 3% of households had a dryer. He says dryers aren't common, even in other developed countries.
In the United States, I find that most people, it's not even on the radar screens to hang dryer clothes. Our grandparents did it. My parents used to do it. But even environmentalists don't even think about it, that I found. I don't know anyone else who hang dries their clothes in the United States, in my community.
Solar Oregon is hosting a social media contest inviting folks to post pictures of their clothes drying. Participants should tag Solar Oregon with hashtag hang dry. Everyone who enters gets a free membership to the organization and a chance to be part of the 2020 Solar Winery Tour. For KBOO Evening News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Imara Moore.
Governor Kate Brown ensured that Oregonians can mail their ballots for free and voters could have more information about who's funding political ads today. Brown said, "In Oregon, we believe that your vote is your voice and that every single voice matters. We continue to be a leader and a champion for the rest of the states." Brown's staff estimated paid postage could cost Oregon nearly $1.6 million, but would cost double for a higher turnout election where voters opt to mail in their ballots. The Bus Project, a Portland group that advocates for accessible elections, argues that paid postage will eliminate barriers to voting among the elderly and people in rural counties. Governor Brown also signed a bill that requires the disclosure of the top five donors who contribute to a candidate.
Last week in San Francisco, more than 100 people gathered in the lobby of a high school to examine a mural titled Life of Washington. This mural was ordered destroyed because of its negative depiction of slaves and Native Americans. It includes scenes of slaves at work and dead Native Americans, which upsets many minority students at the school and their parents as well. Amy Anderson, a parent at the school, said, quote, "That's painful to say that my history is being told in a way that says we're no longer here." Deborah Galinsky, however, whose son also attended the school, had a different view. She said, quote, "I'm offended by people wanting to paint over it and destroy history." On June 25th, the school board voted to paint over the mural. Many art historians and educators have signed a petition in protest. Janet Bishop, the curator of San Francisco's Museum of Modern Art, claimed works of art like this one have been controversial in the past. According to Bishop, quote, "It's really important to take the long view and think about what these murals mean to the city. There are plans to put a measure on the ballot next year to decide what to do with the mural."
In Washington, clinics and schools are addressing physical and mental health issues that can lower absenteeism and improve student outcomes. Imara Moore has more on this story in collaboration with Eric Tegedoff of the Public News Service.
In Seattle, some Washington State students going back to school this year will have more than a school nurse as a health resource. School-based health centers provide a variety of care, including mental health therapy, physical exams, and even dental care. The clinics already are prominent in King County schools, and the movement is growing in other parts of the state. Jill Patineau, Thriving Schools Program Manager for Kaiser Permanente, said health access is an essential part of success at school.
Schools and health, there is a huge point of intersection between the two, and so from the education lens, when you have students that are not healthy, they have a toothache, they're sick, they honestly are not in a place where they can learn.
Patino said the school-based health centers model allow kids to get the care they need without causing a major interruption to their school day. She noted that the mental and physical health clinics in school can lower absenteeism and improve student outcomes, according to studies. Over the next 3 years, she said, Kaiser is providing $1.2 million in startup grants to open clinics in Spanaway and Spokane schools. Dr. Gina Sucato, Kaiser's medical director of school-based health centers, said these centers' ability to address disparities in healthcare access is one of their most important features.
The presence of school-based health centers improves health outcomes for all students, but most especially for those who are traditionally underserved by the medical and mental health communities, because in these school-based health centers, services are available to all students, regardless of their ability to pay.
Patino said state lawmakers are looking at supporting school-based centers, and there is energy building in the health and education worlds to make these clinics more common.
If we can bring the health services to students in schools, we can really contribute to graduation rates and post-secondary completion.
For Public News Service and KBOO Evening News, I'm Imara Moore.
The Dow tumbled more than 700 points today, fueling disarray among global stocks. That's as China escalates its trade war with the U.S. The Dow is on pace for its third worst point drop in history. The Chinese government devalued the yen to fall below its 7-to-1 ratio with the U.S. dollar for the first time in a decade. By weakening the currency, blows imposed by U.S. tariffs could be softened. Wall Street fears the weak yen could ignite a currency war and potentially wreak havoc on the global economy. Investors are showing particular concern, fearing the Trump administration may pose higher tariffs and devalue the dollar, diminishing Americans' purchasing power. The Trump administration announced last week it would impose tariffs on $300 billion of Chinese imports. People's Bank of China Governor Yi Gaiang said that China will not engage in competitive devaluation, though analysts at Capital Economics said the move all but abandoned hopes of a trade deal between the U.S. and Beijing. Tech stocks were hardest hit, with Apple, Intel, Microsoft, and Nvidia leading the pack in losses.
Google pledged today to include recycled materials in all of its products by 2022. Additionally, the company will make all of its shipments carbon neutral by 2020 in order to promote sustainability for its hardware. Google has already been able to reduce carbon emissions by 40% because of their switch from air to cargo shipments. Earlier this year, Samsung announced a similar goal, promising to use sustainable materials in their hardware instead of plastics. The programs from both companies look promising for environmentalists and can only help reduce their carbon footprint. If you'd like to take part, Google currently has a recycling partnership program which provides free shipping labels for your old devices and safely recycles them.
Amazon's most recent transparency report states that government requests for customer data have increased over the past 6 months. This report, released last Wednesday, states that subpoenas for data collected from its websites and devices went up by 14%, and the number of search warrants the company received went up by 35%. Amazon granted authorities access to this data in roughly 4 out of 5 cases. Amazon reported separately for its web services division, the company's cloud storage business, which provides infrastructure to roughly 40% of the internet. Amazon Web Services saw a decrease in the overall number of warrants received, but a 77% increase in subpoenas for cloud-stored customer data. Amazon also recently removed a section from its transparency report relating to the NSA's PRISM data collection program. The section previously claimed that Amazon did not participate in the program. However, the section no longer exists.
Convicted child molester David Ramirez was found dead at the age of 56 in his Florida jail cell last week. The Duval County Jail inmate was allegedly beaten and drowned in his toilet by a cellmate. The attack was witnessed by a third inmate, and video surveillance was also retrieved. Ramirez's official cause of death is pending autopsy results. Paul Dixon has been charged with murder regarding the case. Dixon shared a cell with Ramirez and was doing time for murder. Around 11 a.m. last Tuesday, a verbal confrontation ensued between the two men and escalated to physical violence. Ramirez was doing life after his 2013 sentencing, having been convicted of molestation of an 11-year-old girl. The Jacksonville County Sheriff's Office says incidents of cellmates killing each other are rare, Though it is commonly understood, this is not the case for inmates convicted of crimes against children.
With the prevalence of technology and social media, privacy is constantly an issue. And given the recent surveillance tests from the Pentagon, we once again have to ask if our security is worth our privacy. KBOO's Ethan Fry has the story.
In the far distance, a helicopter skimmed down between the roofs, hovered for an instant like a blue bottle, and darted away again with a curving flight. It was the police patrol, snooping into people's windows. Even in tests, they're still collecting a lot of data. Who's driving to the Union House, the church, the mosque, the Alzheimer's clinic? Well, it may not have sounded like it. These are two separate quotes. The first from George Orwell's 1984, and the second from Jay Stanley, a policy analyst at the ACLU. Stanley's concerns come from recent tests commissioned by the U.S. Southern Command, or SOUTHCOM. FCC documents revealed the test of high-altitude balloons equipped with a variety of radars that would provide a persistent surveillance system to locate and deter narcotics trafficking and homeland security threats. It is unclear whether the tests centered around Nevada are linked to any active investigations, and it is equally uncertain how the gathered data would be used. We would like to know what they are doing with that data, how they are storing it, and whether they are contemplating deploying this in the US, Stanley said. Because if they decide that it's usable domestically, there's going to be enormous pressure to deploy it. Ryan Hartman, CEO of a rival balloon company, Worldview, says that they are aware of the privacy risks. Obviously, there are laws to protect people's privacy, and we are respectful of all those laws, Hartman said. We also understand the importance of operating in an ethical way as it relates to further protecting people's privacy. However, with benefits as vague as deterring homeland security threats, and potential costs of Orwellian proportions, many are justifiably worried. Hartman's reassurance may not be enough to quell those concerns. But even if public action is taken, Stanley is unsure of the results. How long will it take to see change? I don't know. People need privacy and will find ways to get it. What I can tell you is that these issues won't go away. For KBOO News, I'm Ethan Fry.
Louis Ziska, a leading climate change scientist, quit his post in the USDA's Agriculture Department today in protest against actions by the Trump presidency. Ziska claims that one of his studies, which was published in the journal Science Advances, was buried by the administration. He claims they questioned the findings of his study and attempted to minimize its press coverage. Ziska's study was about how rice loses nutrients to the increasing amounts of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, which has implications for more than 600 million people who depend on rice for most of their food. Several government employees also recently reported they had lost their jobs over climate change disagreements, and a Politico investigation showed the USDA regularly buried its own climate research discoveries. Ziska testified that, quote, "It got to the point where language started to change. No one wanted to say climate change. You would say climate uncertainty, or you would say extreme events, or you would use whatever euphemism was available to not draw attention. You get the sense that things have changed, that this is not a place for you to be exploring things that don't agree with someone's political views. To ignore this, to just dismiss it and say, oh, that's political, I don't have the words to describe that. It's surreal. It feels like something out of a bad sci-fi movie."
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Proponents are looking to pass a hate crime amendment to tribal law on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. As China Locket reports, it comes after recent legislation legalized same-sex marriage for the Oglala Lakota tribe.
Monique, or Muffy, Musso has a mission. She wants community members to show support for a tribal hate crime measure.
There should be not any embarrassment of who you are as a person and who you want to be with and who you're attracted to.
The 51-year-old has been traveling to districts on the Pine Ridge Reservation, giving presentations so the Tribal Law and Order Committee can gauge local reactions. There are 9 districts on the Pine Ridge Reservation, and the Pine Ridge District just became the 4th supporting the hate crime proposal. Musso says this ordinance is critical to LGBT people's safety.
There's just been too much violence concerning closed minds about two-spirited, about lesbians, about gays, about bisexuals, about trans persons, are about queers having a place within our tribal system.
Musso says two-spirited people have had a place in Lakota culture for a long time. She says in some Native tradition, they were seen as sacred and even held leadership roles. However, Musso says that changed when European immigrants introduced Christianity. She says these hate crime amendments are a step in realigning the LGBT community with the culture.
And it is imperative that us as people get along and remember that this next law that's coming is for protections.
After the ordinance is presented to the remaining 5 districts, it will be sent to the Law and Order Committee, then voted on by the full tribal council. I'm Chyna Lockett.
New Mexico Congresswoman Deb Haaland discussed health care, climate change, and a number of topics Saturday in Albuquerque with more than 200 people at a town hall. Haaland talked about the 2020 race for president during a press conference after the event. As one of 4 Native Americans in Congress, when asked what issues the Democratic candidates should focus on for tribes, Haaland says they need to hammer on the trust responsibility.
I hope that any debate that involves issues of Indian country, that the candidates truly understand what that means and how they can move that issue forward.
Haaland is backing Senator Elizabeth Warren. The endorsement has received criticism online, including from Native people, about the controversy over Warren's heritage.
I believe very strongly that she admitted, yes, she has Indian ancestry. She wasn't asking to be a member of any tribe. She didn't fill out any tribal, you know, enrollment application or anything like that. I just think that in this day and age, we need as many allies as we can possibly get.
Haaland maintains Warren is the best ally for Indian country and thinks she'll prioritize tribal issues. Candidates, including Warren, have been invited to speak directly to tribal issues at a forum planned for this month in Iowa. Haaland's town hall was held before the mass shootings in Texas and Ohio. Following the news, Haaland was among Democratic lawmakers to call for action on gun violence prevention bills. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Last Tuesday, U.S. Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri introduced a bill that bans addictive social media features. Many social media platforms have an infinite scrolling effect, which allows users to see all the content on their feed if they continue to scroll. If the bill is passed, users have to actively refresh their social media news feeds after their scrolling limit exceeds. It also affects YouTube. Instead of having videos load automatically with autoplay, users have to find and click on the next video themselves. Also, SnapStreak on Snapchat would be prohibited as well. The goal is to discourage users from engaging in social media. Senator Hawley also proposed new features that would be part of a user-friendly interface that includes 30-minute time limits for each app. Individuals could change the time limit, but it would reset each month. The bill was met with resistance by tech experts and other lawmakers after the announcement. Online users said the bill was too restricting. So far, the Senate isn't backing Hawley's bill.
Now it's time for the daily national newscast from the Public News Service. The Public News Service has bureaus in 36 states dedicated to news in the public interest.
The Public News Service daily newscast for Monday, August 5th, 2019. I'm Mike Clifford. The nation deals with yet another round of mass gun violence. Also on our Monday rundown, bipartisan health centers look to secure their funding, plus protecting wetlands from further development. Topping our news, 2 mass shootings took place in 2 different states. The first occurred Saturday at a Walmart in El Paso, Texas. A gunman there killed 20 and injured 26. The second unfolded early Sunday morning in Dayton, Ohio. A gunman there killed 9 people, injuring 16 more. Quartz adds, as of Sunday, if you are counting, the nation is 216 days into the year 2019. Over that time, more than 1,300 people have been injured or killed in mass shootings. The nonprofit organization Gun Violence Archive defines a mass shooting as an event in which at least 4 people were shot. By that calculation, that means at least some 292 mass shootings in the U.S. have occurred since the year began. Meantime, with hate crimes increasing around the nation, a state grants program in Maryland is now accepting applications from religious organizations that want to boost security.
Governor Larry Hogan announced the Protecting Religious Institutions grants as part of his budget in January. This month, applications for the grants are available to houses of worship of all faiths. Howard Libet, executive director of the Baltimore Jewish Council, says that after shootings at synagogues and mosques around the country in recent years, the rise in religious hate crimes is a real concern. Congregations in Maryland have beefed up security by offering training, adding security cameras, and reinforcing doors. But Libet says most have opted to add security personnel.
To have, for example, an armed guard or armed off-duty officer just for a few hours a week during Shabbat services, Friday night, Saturday morning, it's tens of thousands of dollars a year. It's a major expense.
In 2017, 183 hate crime incidents were reported to police and verified in Maryland, according to the state's 2017 Hate Bias Crime Report. Of those, 44 were based on religion. That means that verified religious bias crimes nearly tripled from 2016, when there were only 15. This is Diane Bernard reporting.
The Maryland Governor's Office of Crime Control and Prevention aims to give out $3 million for security grants, which will be awarded on a rolling basis. You may not be aware, but this is National Health Center Week, and Eric Taganoff reports community health centers are celebrating their largest patient reach ever.
This year, health centers are serving 29 million people in areas lacking providers, up by 1 million from 2018. Roughly 4 out of 5 patients who come to these neighborhood health sites are uninsured or publicly insured through programs like Medicaid. A large piece of the health center's funding expires at the end of September, leaving them waiting for an extension from Congress. But they have bipartisan support, and Lisa Rutledge with Western Wayne Family Health Centers outside Detroit says that could provide lawmakers with a rare opportunity to join forces this year.
Getting this legislation passed is a good example of how the parties can work together and how the House and Senate can work together and have it be a win for the many millions of people in the United States who use community health centers.
Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow is leading the charge to get funding reauthorized, alongside Missouri Senator Roy Blunt. In 2017, health centers served nearly 700,000 Michiganders, including more than 215,000 children. There are 45 centers with more than 300 satellite sites in the state.
To celebrate National Health Center Week, Western Wayne Family Health Center is hosting a health fair on Saturday. The idea is to help kids prepare for going back to school. Now to the state of Tennessee, where the governor there, Bill Lee's recent signing of a proclamation making July 13th Nathan Bedford Forrest Day in observance of the Confederate general and an early Ku Klux Klan leader has many people wondering why these decrees are on the books in the first place.
I think many of these sorts of laws were passed in response to the successes of the civil rights movement. And Nashville is at the center of the agitation over civil rights and to a large extent is responsible for many of the successes achieved by the civil rights movement.
We turn to Vanderbilt University Professor Richard Blackett. He says these kinds of laws aren't as old as many people think. Finally, here's Nadia Romlagan. She reports the state of Ohio has lost 90% of its wetlands, and a proposed project could destroy even more.
The Army Corps of Engineers is reviewing a permit for the filling of roughly 15 acres of wetlands for development of a medical campus in Trumbull County. Associate Professor of Geological and Environmental Sciences at Youngstown State University, Colleen McLean, explains wetlands provide filtration to maintain clean water. She says the Ohio EPA already issued a certification approving the project, despite the objections of environmental groups and some residents.
There's a great concern about the loss of the
trees. There's the flooding. The day after the 401 decision came out, there was significant flooding in the Eastwood Mall area, which is downstream, actually. There was also a sinkhole that opened up. There's water quality concerns, the excess runoff, the light pollution, the noise pollution.
Developers say more than 30 sites were surveyed and contend the area is the only viable option.
The developer says it will purchase credits to create a new wetlands in the watershed. This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Following this newscast at 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, we'll hear Prison Pipeline. Emma Lugo interviews Steve Griggs of the Steve Griggs Band about his new album From Fort Worth to Bakersfield. Then at 7, tune into Hard Knock Radio for in-depth interviews and profiles with elected officials, community leaders, activists, hip-hop artists, and musicians. Tonight's weather will have a clear sky and a low of 63. Tomorrow will be sunny with a high near 90, with temperatures cooling off towards the evening with a low of 62. Today in history, in 1861, the U.S. government levies the first income tax as part of the new Revenue Act passed to help pay for the Civil War. Also today, in 1962, Nelson Mandela was arrested and sentenced to 5 years in prison for inciting a workers' strike in 1961. The quote of the day is from Nelson Mandela, who said, "May your choices reflect your hopes, not your fears."
CurrentCast is a daily podcast that highlights issues affecting one of our most precious resources, fresh water. On today's episode, we visit the Western Lake Erie Basin, where migrating songbirds are reshaping the development of wind energy.
Protecting birds on the ground and in the air. On this CurrentCast. The Western Lake Erie Basin is an important stopover site for migrating songbirds. And that means development in the region can impact our feathered friends.
It's a constant vigilance and concern. For birds, not only is the habitat a concern, but, you know, structures.
That's Mark Shieldcastle of the Black Swamp Bird Observatory in Ohio. He says, for example, spinning wind turbines can be a hazard to birds in flight. So, although wind energy helps prevent global warming...
There are a lot of concerns. Sighting is important. You know, putting turbines in a major migration area such as the Western Basin is maybe not the wisest thing to do.
CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
North Korea has reportedly conducted another test launch last Friday morning, the third in just over a week. There's speculation that projectiles fired are short-range ballistic missiles, according to South Korean officials. It's thought the launches fired a pair of KN-23 missiles, a cousin to Russia's SS-26 missiles. Defense analysts say the solid-fuel-type missile is highly mobile and uses extreme speed and an erratic flight path to evade interception. The missiles were launched from North Korea's east and landed in the water separating the peninsula from Japan. The U.S. has downplayed the frequency of recent launches, as reported by NPR's Anthony Kuhn, with President Trump dismissing them as very standard. Trump continued, quote, "Kim does not want to disappoint me with a violation of trust." Washington officials also say these tests will not interfere with resuming talks in Pyongyang regarding North Korea's nuclear weapon reduction. Conversely, North Korea has indicated its displeasure with upcoming military exercises involving the U.S. and South Korea this month. North Korea leader Kim Jong-un has accused South Korean leader Moon Jae-in of double-dealing recently, talking peace with the North while fortifying the South's military defense arsenal.
It's time now for Labor History in 2 with your host, Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1917.
That was the day IWW leader Frank Little was buried in Butte, Montana. Little had been lynched on August 1st by police agents thought to be working for the despised Anaconda Copper Company. He had arrived in town to help organize 14,000 striking copper miners. Devastated by the deaths of 168 miners in the June fire at Granite Mountain and Spectacular Mines, mine workers formed the Metal Mine Workers Union and walked off the job. Frank Little had previously worked as a hard rock miner and organizer for the Western Federation of Miners. He also took part in the free speech campaigns on the West Coast. Little was involved in early drives to industrially organize oil workers and lumberjacks. He voiced his opposition to the First World War and sought to stop workers from enlisting. When Little arrived in Butte in July, he worked to build strike support, picket lines, and spread the strike to other trades across the city. Early on August 1st, six masked men broke into the boarding house where he was staying. He was beaten and taken from his room. His assailants tied him to the bumper of their car and dragged him through the granite streets of Butte to the Milwaukee Bridge, where he was hanged. An ominous note was pinned to his bullet-ridden body with the words that read, "Others take notice, first and last warning." It included the numbers 3, 7, and 77, as well as the initials of other union organizers in the area. As many as 10,000 marched in his funeral procession. Days after his lynching, martial law was declared. Labor radicals were rounded up and charged with espionage. The miners' strike and union were crushed. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at laborhistoryin2.
Colombia granted citizenship today to over 24,000 children born to migrants inside its territory, as well as all those born in the next 2 years. This policy decision is aimed at solving the massive Venezuelan refugee crisis. More than 4 million have fled hyperinflation, blackouts, and shortages of food, water, and medicine in Venezuela. 1.5 million of the refugees have ended up in Colombia. Most nations in the Americas give citizenship to babies born in their territory automatically, but Colombia requires at least one parent to have legal residence. Today's decree will loosen that standard, protecting a generation of children. Colombia has also loosened ID requirements for Venezuelans to migrate, offered special residence and work permits, and opened public schools to migrant children. In sum, their support has been immense. The Colombian president told officials, quote, "Today we can say amid difficulties that the way of xenophobia is not the right way. In defense of brotherhood, we will attend to this situation."
Also in South America, a Brazilian gang leader attempted an escape from prison this morning by dressing as his teenage daughter. Despite the 42-year-old inmate donning a silicone mask, wig, glasses, pink t-shirt, and skinny jeans, his attempt failed. After his capture, officials released photos of the man, who is known by several names. His real name is Clavinio da Silva, but he's also known as Baiacenho or Shorty. Da Silva told prison security he was planning on walking out the front door and leaving his 19-year-old daughter in his cell. Da Silva had previously escaped Rio's Gerestino prison in 2013 using the prison's sewer system. Currently, he is serving a 73-year sentence for drug trafficking.
Facebook has decided to suspend over 350 accounts that were paid for by the Saudi government for what the company refers to as inauthentic behavior. A series of stories released by Qatari news outlet Al Jazeera last month revealed that several accounts disseminating propaganda and disinformation across social media were being run by bot networks paid for and promoted by the Saudi government. Facebook's cybersecurity team looked into the matter and verified that the Saudi government spent more than $100,000 to advertise the now-suspended accounts on Facebook and Instagram. Facebook also announced a separate suspension of more than 350 additional accounts linked to marketing firms in Egypt and the United Arab Emirates. Facebook announces takedowns of bot network accounts multiple times a month, but direct links to governments are rare, according to a statement released by the company earlier today.
Protests in Hong Kong continue as a general strike, now in its fifth day, has brought the city to a standstill. Police are using tear gas and rubber bullets against demonstrators who have taken to the streets en masse, blocking roads and storming police stations throughout the city. Protests began in late May in opposition to a proposed bill that would allow Hong Kong citizens to be extradited to mainland China and tried by Chinese law. The protests have grown into a mass movement aiming to return political sovereignty to Hong Kong, which has been under Chinese administration since 1997. Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, refuses to step down and warns protesters that the city is on the verge of a, quote, very dangerous situation. Many fear that the situation may bring military intervention from Beijing. Chinese authorities are set to make an announcement about the situation on Tuesday morning.
Last Friday, the U.S. withdrew their treaty with Russia and started preparing to test new nuclear missiles. The withdrawal ends the landmark arms control pact that limited the development of missiles. The next U.S. missile test is expected in the coming weeks. According to officials, they'll be testing the cruise missiles that were forbidden due to the treaty. This leaves the U.S. and Russia with only one nuclear agreement, the New START Treaty, which governs weapons and delivery systems for both sides. If the treaty isn't renewed by next year, the world's largest nuclear powers would have no arms limit for the first time in decades. U.S. General Antonio Guterres told reporters that, quote, this will likely heighten, not reduce, the threat posed by ballistic missiles.
And continuing the coverage of our relationship with Russia, Russian President Vladimir Putin has called for new talks with the U.S. after the collapse of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty last Friday. The accord was formally abandoned by the U.S. after claims that Moscow had deployed a missile that violated the treaty's terms. The Kremlin has denied breaking the treaty, and President Putin has stated that if the U.S. were to be found producing new weapons, then Russia would have no choice but to follow suit. U.S. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper says that he would like to deploy new intermediate-range missiles in Asia and that he didn't think it would lead to an arms race because the weapons in question were not nuclear. Putin has ordered Russian defense and foreign ministries to monitor any steps taken by the U.S. toward the development, production, or deployment of any weapons that had been previously banned under the treaty. He added that without a new agreement, the two countries could start an uncontrolled arms race. Trump has said that any new treaties would have to include China as well, but as of now, no talks have been scheduled.
A 6-year-old boy is in critical but stable condition after being thrown 5 stories from the Tate Museum in London. The boy was visiting the museum with his mother Sunday when he was taken from her arms and thrown from the 10th floor viewing platform. He landed on the roof of a 5-story building below. A teenager who had no connection to the victim was arrested after the incident Sunday afternoon for attempted murder. The 17-year-old man was quickly restrained by bystanders and detained by the police shortly thereafter. The city's Metropolitan Police are asking for information from anyone who witnessed the alarming event. The victim was identified as a 6-year-old boy from France whose family was visiting the museum while in London. He was airlifted to a nearby hospital. The museum closed for the remainder of Sunday following the incident, with most of the gallery reopening Monday. The viewing platform where the boy was thrown remains closed to the public.
UN investigators today called for international leaders to impose an arms embargo and strict sanctions that target Myanmar's military and business sectors. The UN investigation reports that the military owns 2 of the nation's largest conglomerates, which are linked to 120 businesses in various sectors, from tourism and banking to construction and gem mining. The report also found 59 foreign companies with commercial ties to the Myanmar military. Following the report, the International Criminal Court initiated a probe into the military-led genocide of the Rohingya people, an ethnic Muslim minority in the region. For more information, we go to Channel News Asia reporter Chanidi Vatvani.
The report, according to the mission, for the first time details the degree to which Myanmar's military has used its own businesses, foreign companies, and arms deals to support operations against ethnic groups with impunity. The mission has called on the UN Security Council and member states to immediately impose targeted sanctions against companies run by the military and do businesses with unaffiliated companies instead. The international community, according to the mission, has been slow to respond to calls for sanctions. So far, sanctions have been applied on 4 of 6 members of the military, and only the U.S. has implemented sanctions on the top 2 military members. Now, 2 companies cited in the mission's report, Myanmar Economic Holdings Limited, MEHL, and Myanmar Economic Cooperation, MEC, the report says, are owned and influenced by senior military leaders, including the Commander-in-Chief, Senior General Min Aung Hlaing, and Deputy Commander-in-Chief Vice Senior General So Win, both of whom the mission has said the mission has previously said must be investigated and prosecuted for genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. The 2 companies own at least 120 businesses in various sectors, ranging from construction to pharmaceuticals, manufacturing, and tourism, among many others, and have perpetrated international human rights and humanitarian law violations, including forced labor and sexual violence in connection with their business activities. Now, the mission has also said that ASEAN has been agonizingly slow in addressing the human rights concerns. The mission has also called for the imposition of an arms embargo, citing at least 14 foreign firms that have supplied fighter jets, armored combat vehicles, warships, missiles, and missile launchers to Myanmar since 2016. At least 15 foreign firms have been found to have joint ventures with the companies run by the military, while 44 others have some form of commercial ties with military-run businesses. The mission says that these foreign companies risk contributing to or being linked to violations of international human rights and humanitarian law. Now, the fact-finding mission will present its final report to the UN Human Rights Council in September.
Miles Johnson is the senior attorney at the nonprofit organization Columbia River Keepers. He spoke with KBOO's Amara Moore on the different issues they're facing and how to become involved.
Who is the Columbia River Keepers and what do you do?
Columbia River Keepers is a nonprofit organization with over 16,000 members in Oregon and Washington, and we protect water quality in the Columbia River and the life that's connected to it, including salmon and steelhead.
How many people are involved?
So we have about 16,000 members throughout the Northwest, and we have a staff of 15 people here at Columbia River Keeper working to protect water quality.
So what are your current projects and issues that you're working on?
One of our biggest issues is trying to protect salmon and steelhead in the Columbia River. We're working to make the river cool enough so that fish can migrate back to their spawning grounds. And the salmon and steelhead in the Columbia River support important fisheries, both here in the Columbia and out in the ocean. And they also support the southern resident orcas that live in Puget Sound and up and down the Oregon and Washington coast.
Do you only focus on the Columbia River, or are there more places that this is located in?
Columbia River Keeper works on the Columbia River and its tributaries.
Can you tell us a little about the rising water temperature and how that's affecting the salmon population?
Sure. So salmon need cool water to survive. And when river temperatures rise above 68 degrees, salmon start to have trouble surviving. There's not very much oxygen in the water when the water gets warm. And it's also easier for fish to get sick, get fungal and other bacterial infections. Because of the dams on the Columbia and Snake River, and because of climate change, the water in the river is becoming warmer and warmer. This happens every summer, and this summer is no exception. The river temperatures, especially in the lower Snake River, are getting well above 68 degrees, and that's causing real problems for fish that are trying to migrate back up to their spawning grounds in Idaho.
When did the Columbia River Keepers realize they had to do something about this?
Water temperature in the Columbia and Snake Rivers has been a recognized problem for a long time, but in 2015, over 250,000 adults adult sockeye salmon died in the Columbia and Snake Rivers because the river got too hot. And that was really a wake-up call to us, and I think a lot of other people in the Northwest, that we need to do something to bring water temperature in the summer back down into a range that's safe for salmon and steelhead, or we're going to start losing more of these fish populations.
How can you become a river keeper? Can you give us any information on how to become one?
Sure. So Columbia River Keeper is part of a nation and worldwide network of water keeper organizations. And water keeper organizations are local groups that use grassroots organizing and legal advocacy to protect waterways in their communities. So for me, I'm a senior attorney with Columbia River Keeper. And so I'm employed full-time protecting the Columbia River. And we have about 15 other full-time people on staff, including lawyers and scientists and activists who work to protect the river. But we also have a network of volunteers who, you know, participate in river cleanups, who make their voices heard when there are important public decisions. And if you go to ColumbiaRiverKeeper.org, there's lots more information about how to get involved.
Is there any information about how to get the youth involved so that children and teenagers can learn more about this issue too?
Yeah, absolutely. If you go to our website, ColumbiaRiverKeeper.org, and click on the Take Action and Our Work links, there's information about how we engage school groups and youth organizations, primarily by taking them out into the field, showing them riparian areas and areas along our river, teaching them about the plants and animals that live there, and showing them how we monitor water quality in the river.
How can others become more involved just in general with the issue, and how can they raise more awareness about it?
Well, again, there's lots of good information on our website, but right now, one of the most important things that you can do is talk to your federal elected leaders in Oregon and Washington. You know, talk to your Congress people and your senators, because we need high-level leadership to solve some of the problems of water temperature and the dams on our river. Specifically, the lower four Snake River dams need to be removed, or we're going to start losing even more of our salmon and steelhead runs. And, you know, there are certainly trade-offs to that. No one is saying that they're not. Looking 20 years into the future, we can either have some of those dams, or we can have strong salmon runs, recovering orca populations, and healthy fisheries on our river. We think the trade-offs are worth it. We think healthy salmon steelhead runs and healthy orcas are a quintessential part of the Pacific Northwest, and they're worth fighting for. And our federal leadership needs to know that people in Oregon and Washington are serious about making that happen.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 5th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ethan Fry, Imara Moore, Jeffrey Wade, and Kenzie Beard. The producer is Tammy Habteas, and our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. A podcast of the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola.
I'm Ken Jones.
And have a great night, everyone.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Feminist Film Night and Planned Parenthood fundraiser on Friday, August 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. This Planned Parenthood fundraiser will screen A Girl Like Her, which tells the hidden history of over a million young women who became pregnant in the 1950s and 60s and were banished to maternity homes to give birth and surrender their babies for adoption. And Jane, an Abortion Service, a documentary of Jane. The Chicago-based women's health group who performed nearly 12,000 safe illegal abortions between 1969 and 1973. There will be a conversation after the films between a former Jane, Judith Arcana, and a girl like her, Lonnie Jo Lee. Again, that's the Feminist Film Night and Planned Parenthood fundraiser on Friday, August 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in Saturday, August 10th for a special edition of Grateful Dead and Friends from noon to 2 p.m. The show will be broadcast live from Bloom Garden Supply for their annual summer party featuring food, drinks, and giveaways. Sun will be hosting and playing tunes from the Grateful Dead and Legion of Mary. Again, that's Grateful Dead and Friends live from Bloom Garden Supply on Saturday, August 10th at noon here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
The time is currently 6 p.m., and you are listening to Labor Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Labor Radio, highlighting the works of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class. Here on KBOO 90.7 FM, where the heart of the community comes alive 7 days a week. My name is Tina Turner Morfitt. I am a member of the AFSCME, which is the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Retirees Union, and the current president of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. Tonight, I'm joined by my sisters in the struggle.
Hi, I'm Dr. Audrey Terrell. I am the Vice President of the Oregon Coalition of Black Trade Unions. I'm also President and CEO of the Dr. Audrey Terrell Institute. And I'm also retired from the staff of the International UAW out of Detroit.
Good evening. This is Deborah Hall with the American Federation of Teachers here in Oregon, also currently the Secretary Treasurer for the Oregon Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. Good evening.
So tonight, our interview is with Jaime Rodriguez, who is the newly elected president of the American Federation of Teachers, and he was voted